I'm Carmen Leigh of Jenkins, Managing Editor of the International Journal of Stroke. The following podcast interview with Dr. Herman Neubauer is based on the article Hemicraniectomy for Malignant Middle Cerebral Artery Infarction, Current Status and Future Directions, published in the June edition 2014 of International Journal of Stroke.
So, hello, my name is Herman Neubauer. I'm a clinical fellow of neurology in Germany. I actually work at the RKU, it's a rehabilitation and university hospitals in Ulm, and my major interest is in the malignant middle cerebral artery infarction and its treatment in clinical trials.
Can you explain what the outcome of a malignant middle cerebral artery infarction is for patients and how decompressive hemicraniectomy can be effective in reducing negative outcomes?
Sure. Well, there's a short answer and a long answer. The short answer is that the natural outcome of malignant middle cerebral artery infarction is very poor, and that decompressive hemicraniectomy is at least life-saving, but most often improves disability. The long answer is that when talking about malignant middle cerebral artery infarction, we have to think about the definition of middle cerebral artery infarction. Well, actually, there is not a generally accepted definition of it, but there is a description of Bernahaki from 1996, and there are the inclusion criteria of the randomized controlled trials. And from that, we can see that malignant middle cerebral artery infarction is defined as a severe MCA syndrome, which follows a uniform course with progressive deterioration in consciousness and respiratory drive, which ends by herniation and death. That's a very good description of it, and for clinical practice is more useful to look at the inclusion criteria of the randomized controlled trials, because they define cutoff values for severity and even for neuroimaging. So when we talk about malignant middle cerebral artery infarction, we have a severe stroke, which is measured on the National Institute for Health Stroke Scale, the NIHSS, which is scaled from 0 to 42. And for dominant hemispheric infarction, the stroke severity is greater than 20. And for non-dominant hemispheric infarction, the severity is greater than 15. The difference is just because aphasia counts more on the NIHSS. The clinical deterioration is measured on item 1A on the NIHSS, which has to count more than one within the first 24 to 48 hours. For neuroimaging, the stroke size has to be more than half to two-thirds of the MCA territory, and the territory of the anterior and posterior cerebral artery may be involved in addition. So when you now imagine a patient who fulfills these inclusion criteria, it is more than obvious that merely because of the size of the infarction, the outcome of the patient has to be very poor, either because he dies or he survives, but because of the size of the stroke with long-lasting disability. Now, to answer the second part of the question, how decompressive hemicraniectomy can be effective in reducing negative outcomes, you have to remember that every stroke, every ischemic stroke, is accompanied by cerebral edema. There are various kinds of cerebral edema, with the cytotoxic edema the most important one. But there's also vasogenic edema, when the blood-brain barrier disrupts and water flows into the brain. And there is also an interstitial edema when CSF can't be drained anymore. So with small infarcts, there is not a major problem with edema, but with big infarcts, like the malignant middle cerebral artery infarction, there is a huge edema, and the volume, the additional volume, which flows into the brain, cannot be compensated anymore. So because of the limited space within the bony skull, a vicious circle starts, and you have a mass effect with edema, which compromises formerly healthy brain tissue. That leads to a rise in intracranial pressure, a reduced cerebral perfusion pressure, a further reduced energy supply to the brain, further edema, and so on and so on. And within 2 to 5 days, the patient dies because of herniation. Now, there have been a lot of conservative strategies to disrupt this vicious circle. This can be first achieved by general measures like maintenance of an adequate blood pressure, of oxygen supply, but also of optimal head and body positioning. And the specific means, such as sedation, barbiturates, buffers, hypothermia, osmotic therapy, steroids, or controlled hyperventilation. However, none of these measures has been effective and supported by adequate evidence in clinical trials, and some measures also seem to be detrimental to the patient. Now, in contrast to these complex pathophysiologic theories which underlie conservative treatment, decompressive craniectomy is based on pure mechanical thinking. The rationale is to remove a part of the skull to simply create external space for the expanding brain and the expanding brain edema, which reduces the brain tissue shifts, the increased intracranial pressure, and finally, which prevents vessel herniation as long as the craniectomy is large enough, that means more than 12 centimeters. Otherwise, the additional volume gained will be too small.
So at what stage in the process does the decompressive hemicraniectomy have an effect on disability?
Well, from what I said, it is clear that when you just remove the skull and you release the pressure from the brain, the life of the patient can be saved. But the biggest concern or fear for years was that by saving the patient's life, you leave the patient severely disabled, bedridden, incontinent, unable to care about his own affairs. And that's why the question arose, how we can treat disability by decompressive hemicraniectomy. So when talking about disability, we use the modified ranking scale to measure disability. This is a clinical scale which is very well evaluated, which is a standard clinical outcome measure of stroke-related treatments in clinical trials. It is a 7-point scale ranging from 0, which means the patient has no symptoms, to 6, which means the patient is dead. Now, coming back to your question, there have been a series of studies in the late 90s that suggested not only a benefit on mortality, but also a beneficial effect on disability of decompressive craniectomy and malignant infarction. However, these studies, they were not randomized controlled trials. Most were retrospective, most were single center. Some used historical controls and all used different time windows from stroke onset to treatment. So because of these bias, it was clear that we needed better evidence from randomized control trials. Between 2000 and 2013, 7 randomized control trials were successfully performed, which compared decompressive hemicraniectomy to standard intensive care treatment. Of these studies, the 3 European randomized control trials which compared decompressive hemicraniectomy within 48 hours of symptom onset in patients aged 18 to 16 years gives the best evidence of the treatment effect. This is because they knew that the patient numbers within the single studies would be very small because of the life-saving effect of decompressive hemicraniectomy. So they decided in advance to pool the data to do a prospective analysis on outcome. And this pooled analysis was published in 2007, and the results clearly showed that decompressive hemicraniectomy is not only life-saving, but reduces disability. Compared to the intensive care treatment, under which 71% of patients died, 78% of patients survived under decompressive hemicraniectomy. The rate of very severely disabled patients, that means bedridden incontinent and needing constant care, which is expressed as an MRS of 5 on our scale, was not increased. This is important. The chance to survive with slight to moderate disability, that means requiring some help but able to walk independently, increased from 21 to 43%. And the chance to survive with moderate to severe disability, which means not able to walk independently, increased 50 times from 2% to 31%. So taken together with decompressive hemicraniectomy, the number needed to treat to save a patient's life is 2, but the number to prevent most debilitability is also 2, and the number needed to treat to avoid death, most of the disability, and moderate to severe disability is 4. And therefore, we used to say that decompressive hemicraniectomy within 48 hours from symptom onset in patients younger than 6 years of age is a life-saving procedure that improves outcome without promoting most of the disability.
So can you give us a little bit of a background on the Destiny 2 trial then?
Sure. So one of the European randomized control trials, which were Deep in Mohammed and Destiny, was Destiny, which is the acronym for decompressive surgery for the treatment of malignant infarction of the middle cerebral artery. So Destiny 2 is a succeeding trial. The rationale was that in the randomized control trials in Europe done before, and also in the Destiny 1 trial, the patients that were recruited were only up to 6 years of age. This was because in the past, several case series, retrospective studies, and systematic reviews suggested that higher age is an important predictor of unfavorable outcomes in malignant infarction. And at least they proposed an upper age limit for the procedure that was between 50 to 60 years of age. However, in the subgroup analysis, the pooled analysis, which I was talking about, there were no indications that patients between 50 to 60 years had a poorer outcome. And furthermore, more than 40% of patients are actually older than 60 years of age. So we had studies and evidence for patients, for only half of the patients we are treating. So as a consequence of both, it was clear that we needed a new randomized control trial, and so Destiny 2 was planned to assess the effect or the efficacy of decompressive hemicolonectomy in patients older than 60 years of age in a randomized controlled trial. And actually, I'm very happy to tell you that Destiny 2 has been published a week ago, and it's reached its primary endpoint by significantly improving the chance of survival without most disability after 6 months. After decompressive hemicolonectomy, the mortality at 1 year follow-up was 43%, whereas mortality in the conservative treated arm was 76%. However, although the study was positive, we have to state that the outcome in the older patients was clearly worse than in younger patients, with one-third of the survivors remaining in a very severely disabled status.
So what else can be done in future clinical trials to improve these measures?
There are actually two things, I think, which should be investigated in the near future. The first one is on the early mortality, and the second one is on the time to treatment. So although we say that decompressive hemicraniectomy is a life-saving procedure, 20% of patients still die in the acute phase. And this relatively high mortality calls for an improved intensive care treatment, for example, by therapeutic hypothermia. Therapeutic hemothermia is an anti-edemase and neuroprotective therapy with proven efficacy in global hypoxia, and that may further reduce mortality in malignant MCA infarction than applied in addition to decompressive hemicolonectomy. And we actually run a randomized controlled trial on that topic, which is called the SOS trial for decompressive surgery plus hypothermia in spite of occurring stroke. And we are waiting for results by end of this year or the beginning of the next year. And the second thing, which should be investigated in the near future, is if there is the best timing for decompressive hemicraniectomy. That means we know that early decompressive hemicraniectomy within 48 hours of symptom onset is effective, but we do not know if earlier decompressive hemicraniectomy, say within 24 hours or within 6 hours of symptom onset, is more effective by disrupting the vicious circle of ischemia and brain edema to an earlier point of time. And there is some evidence from non-randomized studies that there may be additional benefit, but there's currently no evidence from randomized controlled trials. And let's see, maybe we start Destiny 3 next year and investigate on an early or ultra-early hemicraniectomy.
So what are the future perspectives for this stroke type?
Well, besides treating malignant edema in severe stroke, malignant MCA infarction can also be a model for other diseases and strokes which are accompanied by brain edema, for example, traumatic brain injury, metabolic brain edema, or cancer. And it would be interesting to identify safe and effective pharmacotherapy to minimize the brain edema, and that could be of value beyond stroke. There is actually some interesting evidence that the so-called ischemia-induced non-selective Caucasian conduction formed by a so-called SUR1, TRP, and 4 protein complex plays a major role in edema formation. And the interesting thing is that this protein complex can be inhibited by a drug called glyburide, which is an FDA-approved drug for treatment of diabetes mellitus. And there are some mouse models which show a huge effect in brain edema of malignant stroke. However, the quality of studies is not overwhelming, but there are first attempts that are made to transfer glyburide to other diseases. So that will be very interesting in the future.
So why did this review look at data separately for age range, and what, if any, is the difference?
We did look at data separately, first because of the history of malignancy in culture. As I told you, there was first evidence in patient groups from 80 to 60 years of age, because we thought there was a cutoff where decompressive hemicrenectomy is effective, because we did not think that so many people or patients are older than 60 years of age, and because we thought that the atrophy, which is commonly seen in older patients, is protective and to counteract the brain swelling. However, all these assumptions were wrong, and so we decided to do a second trial for patients older than 60 years. Besides of the historical reason for presenting the data for different age groups, there's also reasons regarding to the content. We have to remember that age is associated with a higher mortality and higher disability in any kind of disease, especially in severe stroke. Therefore, it makes intuitive sense to investigate younger and older patients separately. And as we see from the data from the trials, there is indeed a difference. Whereas you would take a treatment decision in young patients with malignant MCA encouraging very quickly because you reduce mortality and disability, you should take an individual decision in older patients because you do reduce mortality, but by the price of a severe disability.
So why do controversies exist with the decompressive hemicrenectomy and MMI?
Well, there are indeed controversies in malignant MCA infarction because different people think differently on matters where there is a lack of scientific evidence.
Could you mind saying that sentence once more, Herman? I'm sorry, it dropped out.
Pardon?
Would you mind answering the question from the beginning again? I'm terribly sorry at the little Skype moment. Could we start again?
No problem.
Thank you. So sorry. Why do controversies exist with depressive hemicraniectomy and MMI, for MMI?
So there are indeed controversies because there are areas of malignant MCA infarction where there's a lack of scientific evidence and where the personal opinion for these issues is very explicit. There are mainly two points of controversies. The first one is because of the site of the infarction, and the second one is because of the functional outcome. So the first one, the site of the infarction, it is a surrogate for the presence of aphasia. So a dominant hemispheric stroke is thought to cause aphasia and a non-dominant not. And it is of intuitive sense to consider that the loss of communication skills with a dominant hemispheric infarction is important for the treatment decision. However, the randomized control trials did not find any difference in functional outcome, in retrospective content, or in quality of life between dominant and non-dominant hemispheric stroke. Furthermore, if you suffer from aphasia because of a dominant hemispheric stroke, the aphasia may improve over time and rarely remains complete. In contrast, when suffering from a non-dominant hemispheric stroke, there are a lot of neuropsychological deficits and depressions, which are very common and which impact negatively on rehabilitation outcome. Nevertheless, the site of the infarction is still of special concern as a treatment decision for a lot of people, and that may deprive patients from an effective treatment. And the second point of controversy is the functional outcome of the MCA infarction. Well, I told you that moderate to severe disability, which we call an MRS of 4 on the scale, which means not be able to walk independently, rose from 2% to 30%. And directly after the publication of the food analysis, the scientific community initiated a debate on whether a MRSO4 can be called a good or a favorable outcome. However, my opinion is that in the light of a devastating disease like malignant MCA infarction, the decision is not to be alive and independent. The decision is to be alive or to suffer from moderate to severe disability. And the problem is that I don't think that this question of the initial therapy outcome should be answered by health academics on the basis of the modified ranking scale. First, the modified ranking scale has a focal and motor function, and it does not tell you anything about neuropsychological deficits or quality of life. Second, we know that disabled people or patients indicate a much higher quality of life compared to healthy individuals who are asked to imagine a comparable situation. This is something we call the disability paradox. Furthermore, the capacity to cope with life-changing experiences generally underestimated. So, in my opinion, the question should not be, does a patient have a good or a favorable outcome? The question has to be, is the outcome the patient suffers still acceptable? And indeed, there are systematic reviews that indicate that the majority of survivors and caregivers express satisfaction with life despite moderate to severe disability. And we know that there are much more quality of life years, quality adjusted life years gained by decompressive hemicrenectomy. The reason for this difference is most probably that besides the motor function, which is commonly measured in stroke, the cultural background, the lifestyle, personality, the social support, and the proper treatment of depression are very important factors in making a life worth living. For me, I draw my conclusion that until we have more data on the functional outcome, we should present the current data in an unbiased way to our patients and caregivers, who should then outweigh the risk and benefits of the treatment and make their own decision accordingly.
You've been listening to a podcast interview with Dr. Herman Nagabaya. This article was based on the hemicraniectomy for malignant middle cerebral artery infarction, current status and future directions, which was published in the June 2014 edition of the International Journal of Stroke. I'm Kamalev Jenkins, Managing Editor. You can download these podcasts from Podbean or via iTunes. IJS has a Facebook page, Twitter profile and a blog. Please like, follow and read us. The International Journal of Stroke is the flagship publication of the World Stroke Organization. Please consider becoming a member. Hopefully, we'll see you in Istanbul in 2014.